my chief worry as a conservative that we have put so much power in the office of the presidency that someday the wrong man could come along. And I wouldn't be so concerned about whether he could use these powers to perpetuate himself in office, but how he would use these powers to destroy people that disagreed with him.
I am very willing to let the American public judge my physical and mental fitness. So today, I applaud China for stepping up. Excuse me, I applaud Canada.
Government is not our master, it is our servant. Its only power, that which we the people allow it to have.
Liberty Watch is an independent program on KVOI dedicated to the notion that government remains servant, not master, and operating in the public interest for which the media in this country was designed by exploring controversy. This helps us to resolve our differences peaceably, refining controversy into clarity through investigation, research, interview of experts, and public feedback. Liberty Watch is based in objective reason and is biased towards individual liberty, and so is not the view of the station or anyone but the host, guests, and callers. Liberty Watch operates outside the realm of political correctness, taking no notice at all of race, creed, religion, ethnicity, political affiliation, or orientation, focusing on content of character in eternal vigilance to the free flow of information about government, technology, current events, and our steadfast Constitution. The program is paid, produced, hosted, and operated by Charles Heller, and any mistakes are solely his responsibility.
Responsibility. It keeps coming up over and over again. We have return guest with us, Dr. Paul Dreesen. He's a senior fellow with the Committee for a Constructive Tomorrow and Center for the Defense of Free Enterprise and a senior policy advisor for the Congress of Racial Equality. And he got his BA in geology and field ecology from Lawrence University and his Juris Doctorate from the University of Denver College of Law. And he is a former member of the Sierra Club and Zero Population Growth. And he has been declared apostate by them, right?
You could say that, something like Patrick Moore also gets all their opprobrium. They've kind of erased him from all the Greenpeace sites.
Yeah, it's like these Photoshop things where you see this hole where a person used to be and a blank spot for the bio.
Exactly. His name is no longer under the photograph because he's disappeared from history.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he's gone.
One of the Greenpeace co-founders, and they don't like him anymore. They have a website, or did anyway at some point, Patrick Moore is a Big Fat Liar.
Yeah, like that book that the former senator wrote about Rush Limbaugh as a Big Fat Liar, and he wrote it around in circles to take up more space on the pages because he didn't have enough copy to fill a paragraph, let alone a book. Let's see. So you were on approximately 6 weeks ago. This doesn't set a record for having somebody back on a short cycle, but it's very unusual that I do this. But the reason is we talked about your book, Eco-Imperialism, Green Power, Black Death, by Paul Dreesen, and it is a 20-year-old book, which we usually don't do, but I went out and actually bought it retail, and I am keeping it.
Well, thank you.
Really good. I don't keep very many paper books anymore. I usually read the galley or the PDF of them. But this one I'm keeping because it's kind of a, like I told you off the air, I could actually take your bibliography and book 5 interviews on it. I mean, it's really very an impressive tome. So I want to ask you on Foundation, what makes you interested in the topic of the abuse of freedom?
Well, you know, I was involved in the environmental movement in college and post-college. In fact, I was one of the organizers in my college for the very first Earth Day back in 1970.
Wow.
We had a lot of rivers around Wisconsin where I grew up that were laden with paper mills and therefore a lot of pollution and other industrial pollution. The rivers were not exactly swimmable in many cases. You certainly didn't want to drink anything out of them or even catch the fish and eat the fish. But over the years...
Maybe that explains my personality.
Yeah, it could be it. But over the years, we cleaned them up. We had a lot of pollution issues in the 40s and 50s and 60s, but we tackled the problems and we cleaned them up, and that was the vital role of the environmental movement. Mm-hmm. Once they did that, they needed more roles to play in our lives, and they got taken over by more and more radical people. They got more and more money infused. They started pressuring banks and financiers and companies and so forth, government agencies, to give them more money. And they became more and more intolerant in their views, more and more opposed to an industry, to modern agriculture, to modern living standards. And they used all kinds of phony arguments about climate change and agricultural pollution and genetically modified crops and so forth to drive their agenda, which really boils down to putting people with those views that they have, the most radical elements in their so narrow society, in charge of our lives, our living standards, our liberties, our opportunities, our choices on food and travel and cars and homes and heating and air conditioning and just about everything in our lives, the stuff that you have gotten into over the years. Mm-hmm. And I just got really fed up with the lies that I saw them telling. I've been around them and in their ranks for so many years, and I started seeing that much of what they were saying about whatever topic you want to bring up was just bald-faced lies. So I parted ways, and I started really taking a look at what the impact of these environmental policies were on poor people in America, but especially poor people overseas.
Yeah. Is that what you referred to as eco-imperialism?
Yes. Mm. It's the use of environmental and ecological needs and principles and ideas against other people. The people in charge, our ruling elites, use these environmental ideas, especially the ones that are manufactured or exaggerated or just developed computer models that have no basis in reality. And they use what comes out of their mouths and out of their computers to browbeat and pummel people all around the world and try to keep their living standards low if they're overseas, or reduce their living standards if they're in modern industrialized companies.
Sort of beat them into submission to a Marxist ideal.
Yeah, exactly. And to take away their quality of life, their living standards, their jobs, they're callous about it. They don't care what happens to the average person around the world. Take a look at what's going on in Germany, where they are just destroying the industrial base of Germany,
right,
because companies can no longer afford the energy it takes to run a company, especially an automobile or chemical company. They take a tremendous amount of energy. They employ thousands, tens of thousands of people, and when those people are dumped on the streets, they have very little recourse. When the cost of electricity goes from what it used to be, about 15 cents a kilowatt hour in Germany, to about 45 cents now, people can't afford to heat their homes or cool their homes. The companies can't afford to stay in business. They ship their entire business overseas to China or someplace else in Asia, and the jobs go with them. The pollution gets worse because there are no standards over there to speak of. And so the overall global pollution, whether it's greenhouse gases, which is really not a pollutant, it's just carbon dioxide that we breathe out and plants need to grow and prosper. But the water pollution, the toxic pollution, the working wages, everything gets worse. But the people back in Europe are struggling because they no longer have the jobs and living standards that they enjoyed just a few years ago. Mm-hmm. And they're becoming more and more angry about it. The people in Asia and Africa are saying, You can take all your ideas about skipping fossil fuels or forgetting about our living standards and our health standards and improving our lives and our hospitals and our homes and so forth, and you can stuff them where the sun never shines because we're not going to go down that path.
Do environmental nonprofits abuse their status to put pressure on for-profit companies to that end?
Is that a real question?
How do they do that?
Yes, exactly. That's exactly what they're doing. They have done that for many years, and they've become very adept at it. And yet the media, because the media has come out of the same educational system, the politicians, especially on one side of the aisle, they support this because this is their power base as well, and because they agree with a lot of these ideas, and they've been as brainwashed as the current members of many of these environmental groups. So, yeah, they do abuse this 501c3 status, supposedly, for organizations that promote education and health and public welfare, mm-hmm. and they use it to get their tax deductions and to just destroy much of what really is the foundation of our health and public welfare.
On that note, we got a break coming up, so let's go ahead and take the first break of the hour with Paul Dreesen. The book on the table is Eco-Imperialism, Green Power, and Black Death, and we'll discuss it more on the other side of the break. In the Wilkinson Wealth Management Studios, you're all invited to join in, 520-790-2040.
If this college doesn't meet our demands, we'll burn it to the ground.
We planned to keep this encampment until the university agreed to our demands.
There's no right here.
The beaches of Normandy.
Sir, what do we do?
Get off these beaches. Just move forward. Get off the beach.
Who is he?
His name is Novak.
He was just a kid.
All right, man, move on.
I brought you here to Normandy for a reason, son. It's sad to see so many graves, isn't it?
Dad, this one says Ray Novak. He was only 17 years old. Did he die in vain?
He didn't die in vain. He paid a great price. He paid for your freedom.
May we think of freedom not as the right to do as we please, but as the opportunity to do what is right. Exercise your freedom to choose an automotive shop that loves America. Call 323-8650 and perfectionautoworks.com.
I'm Oliver North, and like you, I'm listening to Liberty Watch with Charles Heller, Tucson, Arizona.
This is Herman Cain. You'll get some good bargains on the Swap Shop on AM 1030, KVOI, The Voice, and have Charles make fun of your stuff.
In 1876, the Winchester Repeating Arms Company came out with its Centennial model, chambered in the powerful 45-60 cartridge. 45-60 meant a 45 caliber bullet over a charge of 60 grains of black powder. Listen to the brass lifter as I work the action. Now I'll slide the dust cover forward. You may see the 76 at Frontier Guns, 3156 East Grant Road, where they've been since 1971. You can own this piece of history or trade in one of yours at Frontier Guns, 3156 East Grant.
Hi folks, this is Rob from Blade Runner Knives, inviting you to come see our great selection with popular brands of everyday carry knives, hunting knives, axes, swords, and we are especially proud of our custom and local pieces. We also have a speedy sharpening service. We're at 907 West Prince Road at the corner of Prince and Fairview, around on the Fairview side. Blade Runner sharpens knives fast.
It's not that easy being green. It could make you wonder why. But why wonder, why wonder? I'm green. And it'll do fine, and it's beautiful, and I think it's what I want to be.
Might help to turn the microphone on. And welcome back to Liberty Watch with Paul Dreesen of the book Echo Imperialism, Green Power and Black Death. And I just couldn't resist, having been a former member of the Green Movement, I just couldn't resist playing Kermit the Frog for you.
Well, that was absolutely on target. And the reality is, Charles, that it is easy being green for the eco-imperialists. They get to dump all over everybody else. It's just not so easy for us on the receiving end of their policies.
Well, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and climate change is a good example of that.
Okay.
They're talking all the time about how climate is the existential threat to our people and planet of our time. But in reality, the threat comes from the policies that are being implemented in the name of stopping climate change.
Well, climate has always changed.
Always.
There's nothing wrong with climate change. It's a natural, it's just the process.
And it's been going on for time immemorial.
Right.
I mentioned I grew up in Wisconsin. I have a rock right here in front of me that I dug out of the stone quarry a mile from my boyhood home, and it shows the scratches, the striations across this whole area where my home is now.
Mm-hmm.
From the last glacier that came across Wisconsin. Five glaciers across North America and Europe and Asia. And they came and they went. So you would have ice a mile or 2 miles thick across the continents, pulling so much water out of the oceans that the oceans were 400 feet lower than they are today. And then the glaciers would melt, and then they'd come back five separate times. And that, to me, is A, proof positive, of course, of climate change, but B, proof positive that this is something that has been a natural occurrence on monumental scales.
The
glacial age and what it does to the, certainly the land and whatever was used to be underneath where the glacier is now, but the whole planet freezing down and having very little plant growth, a terrible place to live because it's so cold, and then it goes away, and then it comes back, and you know that this is not something humans did.
Oh, no, so, Paul, I got to disagree with you. They're working on indicting Trump for it.
Okay.
Limbaugh used to talk about groups which took up causes which couldn't speak for themselves, such as either trees or animals. He would talk about these constituencies that couldn't speak for themselves, such as trees or animals. I call these silent witnesses. If the trees could talk, do you think that they'd tell the Environmental Defense Fund to go to hell?
I don't know about that, but they certainly would say their ideas are nutcase ideas, that there's no foundation for them. You know, they find all kinds of forests buried under these glaciers, the ones that are retreating right now, and they find seacoasts, ocean beaches, a couple hundred feet under the current ocean level. So I think the trees and the rocks are smart enough, if you want to make them into human beings, smart enough
them, right?
To tell the truth and know what the history of the world really is and was.
Well, I'll tell you, I think you ought to start a nonprofit called Voices of the Trees and purport to speak for them. Mark, a science teacher. Mark, go ahead.
Yes, thanks for bringing back this great guest. And before you end your show, let me know how you spell his last name.
Dreesen.
All right.
And don't confuse me with the other Paul Dreesen, the Dutch-Canadian guy who is a cartoonist and has done some brilliant cartoons over the years and even been nominated for Academy Awards. I occasionally get mistaken for him, and people will come up to me and congratulate me for something the other guy did or was awarded for. So,
long time ago, in the mid-1970s, I was high school in Bavaria, and we started hearing things about acid rain. And what it really was, I found out some time later, is that there are some mines in a Bavarian mine somewhere that had tailings and acid types of byproducts of the mining going down creeks and into other tributaries and going through a forest. And those were the trees that were affected by the so-called phantom acid rain, which they never could detect, apparently. And, of course, it would show aerial photos of these trees all, brown and dead looking. And then the same that happens all around the world. That's because of the coal-fired power plants creating acid rain. Now, is there truly an acid rain, or was this another hoax?
Yeah, from my own work in these areas, I would call it closer to a hoax than anything else. If you had enough pollution going up in the air from smokestacks in unregulated countries, the sulfur dioxides and so forth would get turned into some acidic rainfall. Rain is generally a little bit on the acidic side, just a little bit. But you also have an additional issue, which is just in forest areas where you have the water sitting in areas that have a lot of fallen debris, you get the tannic acids, and you'll get some very acidic waters in those places. They generally tend to be in the brownish area. And right nearby there might be, like where I grew up in Wisconsin, just a little bit further over there'd be a lake that's in a totally limestone area, and it's very alkaline. So crystal clear from the alkalinity and not much life in the bottom because it's all limestone. And just a half a mile away, there'd be this very tannic acid lake that's brownish and still pretty clear, again, with somewhat minimal life, different types of critters that live in those two places, ones that that need the alkalinity and others that need the acidity. And then in between, there would be lakes that are pretty much normal, neutral, and you had a much greater pantheon of life living there. So, you know, you take something like that and you turn it into a big scare story to push your agenda. I remember a conversation I had with a couple of environmental activists about the Chesapeake Bay, and they were all worried that the crab larvae were far less numerous in a particular year because of acid rain. And I said, well, you know, the last couple of springtimes have been marked by tremendous downfalls of rain. So that dropped the acidity, the pH of the water in the Chesapeake Bay, and that has a negative effect on the crab populations. Did you look into that? And they responded, no, because we don't want to look at that kind of stuff. We're only looking at acid rain.
Yeah.
So that should say something about the way these organizations operate as well, and the way some of the professors and students operate in their own academic realm.
Looking at science, Paul, is racist.
That's right. And also, back then, they were saying that in the 70s, apparently, there was a colder kind of a temperatures in the 70s, and I just heard that on our local news. They were showing decades of highs and lows, and they said, well, in the 1970s, it was a colder period of time, and which is unusual for the news to say such a thing. But then they were telling us that we were going to have another ice age and that we better start moving south. Because I was in a country north of Canada at the time called Michigan.
Yeah, and Charles, it was amazing. Time Magazine and a number of other magazines had cover stories about the coming ice age and how the vast majority of scientists agreed that this is where the planet was heading, and it was all due to our use of fossil fuels. Funny how things change, and now it's planetary warming. And
well,
then it becomes climate change and weather extremes, and everything is due to our use of fossil fuels. You start looking at fossil fuels being the cause of anything that happens on the planet, and you know it's a bogus claim.
Humans must have fixed that chilling effect and gone the other way, so we've warmed up the planet now.
Yeah. And the reality is, the worst thing that could happen is not global warming with more carbon dioxide in the air, because that'll make plants grow better and crops grow better, habitats flourish, animals flourish, people flourish. But the opposite, where the planet is cooling off and there's less carbon dioxide in the air because you'll have shorter growing seasons, less arable land moving northward, and starvation for animals and plants that don't get enough CO2, and for people. So you get if we're trending into another ice age at some point, that's what would be disastrous. That would be an existential threat to our planet and civilization as we know it today.
There's a magnificent article online, and it's hard to find because the Google wants to bury the article. You have to search very hard for it. But it's called Fire and Ice, and it's by two authors. And it was in, I think it was in the late 80s that they wrote it, maybe a little earlier than that. And they talked about the cycle of cooling and warming that has been news on and off since the late 19th century. And they talk about the alternate warnings of impending ice ages and impending warming and the shift every 20 or 30 years from panic about one or the other. It's really interesting. After your comment, I'm going to play the next break.
Yeah, I would love to find that article myself. You know, the reality is that the 1930s, the Dust Bowl years, still mark the record high temperatures in most of the U.S. states and other parts of the world. And then during the 40s and 50s and beyond, the temperatures globally, Europe, if you remember the Battle of the Bulge and all that stuff, mm-hmm. the temperatures started going down again before they started ticking up later in the 70s. Mm-hmm. So again, the same thing, the cycles.
You would think that in all of World War II, with all the things that were on fire, that it would have contributed greatly to a warming of the planet, but it doesn't seem to have.
That's an interesting point. It's crossed my mind a number of times, too. You look at what we did to Ploiesti, Hamburg,
right.
Dresden, so many places that we firebombed, Tokyo, and all the general battling and burning. Talk about putting a lot of carbon dioxide in the air from those fires. And at the same time, Vesuvius was erupting over
right.
Naples while B-24s were dropping bombs on Naples.
Right. Well, I think more Ploiesti than Tokyo, because Tokyo was just wood and paper. But Ploiesti was a tremendous amount of hydrocarbons that were ignited. And Ploiesti was 178 B-24s opening up the entire bomb bay on them. That was way more than either Dresden or Tokyo.
Certainly from the hydrocarbon basis.
Right.
I'm not sure about overall contributions to an area the size of Hamburg or Tokyo or Dresden in terms of cityscape deliberately turned into fireballs where we would drop regular bombs first and then come in with incendiary bombs to turn all that rubble into a firestorm that just incinerated 100,000 people.
Yeah. More so than either Hiroshima or Nagasaki, by the way.
Yeah.
So, let's see. I've got this covered up and I need to push the button and get break two rolling. And, yeah, let's do that. And then I need to talk to you off the air. I found the article, and I'll send it to you, but I don't want to ask your email on the air. So hold on. We'll be right back.
Thank you for listening to Liberty Watch.
Sunday mornings, you can buy, sell, or trade anything lawful and moral on the Swap Shop.
Bunker is so funny. Is he married?
Bunker, call back.
It's Bunker, and I'm single, and I'm looking for a rich widow with a large ranch.
I've never even been on online dating. I believe in meeting people the old-fashioned way, alcohol and bad judgment.
She sounds like your type, Bunker.
Swap Shop, Sundays 10 to 11 a.m., right before Liberty Watch.
Tucson Way, there's a small cafe where they play a little cowboy tune. The dealer had a knife, the dog had a gun, the cat had a shot of rye.
The cat talk, what tales he tell, about Della and the deer and the dog as well. But the cat was cool, he never said a mumble in word.
Left Tucson in a pickup truck, gonna make some things come true.
And talking about making dreams come true and maybe even revealing dreams that have been rained upon is Paul Dreesen in his book Echo Imperialism, Green Power, Black Death. And it's Paul Dreesen, Dreessen. And he describes, he's been describing what Echo Imperialism is. And I had some things I wanted to ask, but Mark, did you have a follow-up?
Yes, another thing about carbon conservation is in my mini compact orchard, I planted these trees in the middle of the desert. I had to punch through what we call caliche and worthless ground. There's no soil there. It's just devoid of soil material, basically. So I had to kind of make my own soil.
Okay, Mark, get to the point.
Today, these trees have created an enormous carbon wells, and now they're loaded. Black dirt is loaded with earthworms and very good soil. And I think that's because of the trees converting what was in the soil into carbon.
And what was in the air, carbon dioxide.
Right. Sucked it out of the air and transferred it to the ground, to the roots.
Yeah. And look what Israel has done with drip irrigation and other technologies to turn a desert that gets one-fourth the rainfall of Arizona and turned it into amazing agricultural production areas.
Yep, land of milk and honey.
Yeah, but they had to create the milk and honey. It wasn't going to just be there. Maybe in the more northern central parts of Israel where you had pretty good weather, but you get down south into the Negev and it is dry, and yet it is booming in agricultural productivity.
Yep, evidently.
And here's another interesting aspect of that. The Israelis are working very closely with none other than in your backyard, University of Arizona in Tucson.
Mm-hmm.
They have an official partnership to develop more and more technologies and techniques to turn desert areas into thriving agricultural areas.
And they're working on a cow that gives kosher milk.
Yeah.
Okay, Mark. What is CSR, or corporate social responsibility, and in what way is it weaponized?
Well, that's interesting because when I wrote the book, the rage was about corporate social responsibility, how corporations needed to give back and do things that were socially responsible as though they weren't doing it in the past. And over the years, we just have new acronyms and new terminologies. It got turned into environment, social, and governance, ESG.
Yeah.
And it got turned into DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion. But it's pretty much the same things pushing the same agenda, which is anti-oil and gas and coal. It's anti-capitalism. It's anti-USA and West. And it's anti-modern civilization and modern living standards. What is pro is putting people with those anti-everything views in charge of our lives and our living standards and our opportunities and our choices, just what you get into with Liberty Watch. So they really think they know far more than they do, because in reality, they don't know much of anything about energy and agriculture and the economics and real human rights, or what actually makes a nation or a world thrive and provide opportunities for billions of people. I don't think they care a whole lot about people or planet, because most of the so-called solutions they promote are very harmful to people and planet, and we can delve into that over the issues of wind and solar and battery-powered cars. But they sure know how to use and get and use their power, the laws, regulations, courts, and so forth, and they have tens of billions of dollars, literally tens of billions of dollars at their disposal every single year, courtesy of rich people like Michael Bloomberg, who also doesn't know a whole lot about agriculture. There's a great quote from him that we can bring up in a second. But these billionaires, their foundations, government agencies, corporations that just keep pouring money into their coffers to do all this evil stuff.
So what could be done to interrupt, without violating the principles of liberty, what could be done to interrupt the flow of money into there?
Well, that's a darn good question. Certainly,
I didn't say it would be easy, Paul.
No, in terms of without trampling on liberties of some of the donors, I'm just saying it's not easy.
Right.
These organizations shouldn't get their tax-deductible privileges, because what they're doing is not educational. It's disinformation, misinformation, uneducation, and it's harmful to so many millions and billions of people. people as well as the planet as a whole, and I don't think they merit those tax breaks that they have.
I agree with you. The only thing is what some people, especially conservatives, don't grasp is that just because someone either doesn't agree with us or is actively lying doesn't mean we have the right to cancel their speech any more than they have the right to cancel ours. And that's where some conservatives walk over the line.
I agree with that, but that doesn't mean they should get our tax-deductible dollars.
Oh, I agree with that. I'm not disagreeing with you at all. I'm just saying that at some point you cross the line over viewpoint discrimination from government, and you can't do that. They can no more cancel you than we can cancel them. That's what we call competition in the marketplace of ideas.
Right. What I'm saying is basically they get all the money. The government gives conservative groups virtually nothing, and in most cases the conservative groups do not want the government money because then it comes with all kinds of government strings.
Right, yeah.
But the left is getting massive amounts of government money and massive amounts of tax-deductible money for very questionable purposes, ends, and activities. Why do we need to keep giving them tax deductions?
Amen.
To encourage people to pour money into their places.
What's your website? If people want to read more about you, how do we do that?
You can find hundreds of articles by me on townhall.com. Watts up with that, WATTS up with that.com, CFACT.org, CFACT.org.
Mm-hmm.
All right, those are probably the three best places to look.
We're at the three-quarters of the hour mark, so I'm going to start rolling the break. Can you stay over one more segment?
Oh, absolutely. Let's do it.
All right, so I'll take you past the top of the hour one segment or 15 minutes. It's actually about 14. And in the meantime, we'll be right back.
This rendition of Taps, brought to you in respect for Memorial Day by Perfection Auto Works.
This is Dennis Weaver, and you're listening to Liberty Watch. You know, the exchange of ideas is so important to maintain our freedom in this country. And Liberty Watch is a show that promotes freedom.
Swap Shop trains are coming. Rolling down that free market track.
Sunday mornings, you can buy, sell, or trade anything lawful and moral on the Swap Shop. Let's listen.
Earth to JD, did you disappear on me?
He's
calling on the next line.
Hey, how about now?
There's a specific phrase we use to get the caller back.
Give my caller life!
And look at that, he's back.
Swap Shop, Sundays 10 to 11 a.m., right before Liberty Watch.
So people get up and take a stand. You better do it now while you still can. Global warming's an illusion. Let's all protect from an illusion of global warming.
And welcome back, where we take the other side's music, edit it a little bit, and stuff it down their intake. And you can do the same. And Paul Dreesen of the book Eco Imperialism, Green Power, Black Death, why does it seem that the people in the so-called, to use my Kermit the Frog voice, environmental movement seem to care more about the environment than about human beings?
That's an excellent question. Before we jump into that,
sure.
Let me make two quick comments. Number one, I want to congratulate Mark for what he did in the desert with the caliche and turning it into an oasis of trees. Two, that was probably the most wonderful, beautiful rendition of Taps I've ever heard. And it reminds me that tomorrow is Memorial Day.
Mm-hmm.
we're honoring those who gave their last full measure of devotion. And I think those who were terribly wounded, lost their ability to walk, or they're burned terribly, lost limbs and so forth. But it reminds me as well that tomorrow is Rolling Thunder. All the bikers that are going to leave right from a half mile from my home here in Northern Virginia, going down Route 50 all the way into D.C. Thousands of bikes will just be rolling together into D.C. in honor of those veterans and Memorial Day people that gave their lives for this country, for our liberty, and for other people in other lands.
That rendition, the same one I played for you, they do at tonight at the Tucson Pops Orchestra. And what they do is they take a bugler and they put him just over the hill inside the venue. It's an outdoor venue, the Reed Park Band Shell. It's called the Demeester Auditorium. And they put a bugler just over the side of the hill, and then one up close, but not in the orchestra, but in the front section, in the front center section. And the front bugler starts out with the da, 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 da. And right about the second phrase there, the bugler in the back begins the echo. And it makes a beautifully emotionally impactful presentation of the song.
Wow. And you're getting that from two buglers.
Mm-hmm. That are not co-located. They're actually
right.
Kind of stereoscopically positioned so that you get the echo effect. The slight difference at the speed sound travels, the slight perceptual difference by separating them by about 150 yards or so is stunning.
And it's also echoing off the walls, so you get a slightly different tonal quality.
No walls. Not really walls there. There's a band shell. But it's not.
Yeah, but I'm sorry. Natural walls, the hills,
the hill,
so
right.
Forth around,
And the trees. Yeah. Yeah, yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
It just changes the tone just a little bit, so it's just mystical.
Right. It is. It absolutely
material.
Is. Plus, you get the ground absorption of a little bit and reflection of the waves. It actually, you're right. There is some type of an echo, but it's not the same as if you were playing against the side of a building. Anyway, why do the so-called environmental movement people seem to care so much about the environment than they do about human beings?
That's a very tough thing to actually answer. I think it depends on which environmentalist, but I think they just basically have turned human beings and modern industries, modern technologies into something evil. And they are fighting that evil devil that is destroying the planet, so they say they would like to get rid of 90% of the human beings on this planet and bring it back to primordial times. Of course, they don't want to be among the 90% that disappeared.
Yeah, they don't want to go back into
the
ooze.
10% left.
Yeah, yeah. I need to go a little quicker, so let me go on to the next thing I want to ask you about, which is, what are precautionary theories?
Basically, that if you can conceive of a problem from a technology, you should prevent that technology from entering our reality. So even fire, because fire could burn something down.
That was my next question.
So you ignore all the benefits you might accrue from fire and focus on the negatives. And the negatives are generally in the brain of these crazy people who can conjure up all kinds of disasters, whether it's genetically modified crops or it's fossil fuels or it's cars. Whatever is being proposed or whatever is there is bad because they think of all these terrible consequences of having it, but they never look at the benefits of or the problems of not having it. They never also look at the benefits of
having it. Yeah, the cost-benefit ratio.
It's totally out of whack. Yeah.
The free market economy relies on the ability to engage in risk in order to gain a reward. How have we become so averse to risk over the past, say, 50 to 70 years?
I think it's just been pummeled into us. Everything that happens has some bad actor that caused it. It's never our fault. It's desire to hold somebody accountable, whether it's blaming ExxonMobil for climate change, or it's blaming some other company for something else. I'm always reminded of the guy that sued the ceiling fan company for damage to his kid because he lifted his kid over his head and forgot that the ceiling fan was there. And yet he wanted to blame the ceiling fan company for having a fan that spun around and whacked his kid. It was people who were risk takers who found America, I mean, discovered it, however you want to put it,
right.
Were seafarers, people that go beneath the sea, people that go in the air, people that go to outer space. They're risk takers still, but the bulk of us, our ancestors came here risking all kinds of things to come to the United States or to come to America. And over the years, we've lost that imperative to try things, to take chances, and to seek the greater rewards. So there's still a lot of people who do that, but there's a tremendous number who just, for a lot of crazy reasons, they just can't understand the idea of risk, whether it's crossing the streets or taking a shower, climbing out of the bathtub. They're scared of everything.
So what happens, if I may, because we are only a couple minutes till the top of the hour break, what happens when you restrict the third world's ability to be entrepreneurial and to get new energy sources and things like that? What's the net result of that?
Yeah, the net result is that they get to have a solar panel on the roof of their mud and thatch hut, enough power each day to charge a cell phone and run a one cubic foot refrigerator and have a light bulb. That's what you're giving them. And you are telling them that they don't have a right to these technologies, or to have, they don't have a right to take a few risks with those technologies to seek the betterment that comes with those technologies.
Wait a minute. How are they going to listen to talk radio?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I guess if they've got a solar panel on the roof of their hut, they can still charge their cell phone and pick you up that way, but they don't get to do much else.
That's going to crater our Nielsen ratings.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I know. I can stay serious for only so long because, and I'll tell you why, it's not just a personality quirk. It's because, although it's that, but it's that humor, like Stranger in a Strange Land, Robert Heinlein said, the humor to grok it in fullness is to say that it is a defense against all things cruel and rotten.
Yeah, and you have to have a sense of humor or you become totally despondent. Whether you're a nurse or a doctor in an emergency ward, you've got to be able to crack the bad joke and see the humor in things, or you just totally lose it. You give up your willingness to be alive.
Yeah, I know some people in radio that could use that advice.
Yeah, don't we all?
All right, I'm going to take the top of the hour break now, and then we'll come back and we'll do one segment with you, because I still got about seven more questions I wanted to get to. And
okay.
Dagnabbit, you are too good a guest to let go of that easily, so stand by. And on AM 1030, KVOI, Cortero, Tucson, The Voice. There you go, FCC. There's your legal ID.
Welcome to America Armed and Free, a program dedicated to preserving your God-granted, constitutionally guaranteed individual right to keep and bear arms in defense of self or state, understanding that the citizens are the militia. This program is produced by Charles Heller and is not endorsed by anyone who isn't pro-choice on freedom.
We are the guardians of America.
Armed and free. Indeed, we are the guardians of America, armed and free, both in uniform and not. I forgot to ask you, Paul, are you a veteran?
I am not. I flunked my commissioning physical coming out of college. I was in ROTC and played football and got both of my knees blown out, so they didn't want me anymore.
Uh-huh.
Otherwise, I would have been.
Yeah, got it.
Yep.
All righty. So we talked about what happens when you restrict the third world's ability to get energy sources. How important to improving conditions of impoverished peoples around the world is developing inexpensive energy resources?
It is the sine qua non. You can't do without it.
Mm-hmm.
It is essential. Affordable, reliable, abundant energy that's there when you need it, not when the weather cooperates with you and your needs. Just look at everything that we do and have and eat, drink. It all is based on energy that's affordable to the companies, to you, heating your home, cooling your home, having a job. Everything we do relies on that, whether it's electricity or it's fossil fuels in your tank of your car, fossil fuels that run your agricultural operations and put the food on your table or transport it to you. We can't live without that stuff, and this is the real evil of the modern environmentalist movement. They want to keep all that away from us. They think that we're going to have a better life if we only go with wind and solar, but you have to have a backup because wind and solar is there only 20-40% of the year. That means the rest of the time you have to have something else providing that electricity, or you go into blackout mode.
What percentage of the world's power comes from wind and solar right now?
6 or 7%, maybe, maybe a little less if you're looking really globally. Some places it's more, so it probably evens out somewhere between 5, 6, 7%. And that may be a stretch if you're looking at wind and solar only, and worldwide.
Hmm.
But in the bottom line is the sources of wind and solar and battery backup power are so environmentally destructive themselves that
mining
has to be looked at very carefully, not just the land use by the wind turbines and solar panels, the birds that are chopped out of the air by the wind and solar panels, but the fact that those technologies require 10 to 15 times raw materials per megawatt than a modern gas-fired power plant. So you have build all those wind turbines and solar panels, and then you have to have a massive number of batteries that can go spontaneously into combustion, just catch fire and spread that fire all over, and you can't put the fires out. So you've got the mines that go to dig out all those raw materials, the processing that's highly polluting. You've got the manufacturing. You've got to ship them thousands of miles. You've got to install them. Then when they're done through their productive life, you've got to find a way to dispose of the batteries, the solar panels, and wind turbine blades. So this is not free, green, sustainable, renewable. It's all the opposite of that. And people just don't think about those things.
Now, they don't reason from cause to effect. That's one of my main objections, is people that don't reason from cause to effect, that don't understand what the effect of either what they say or what they do is going to produce. It's one of the things that from my earliest memories, I think about what my father told me about reasoning from cause to effect when I wanted to be emotional about a thing. And he just looked at me and said, look, you've got to look at what you do and what it's going to cause and what that's going to result in, and you can't get upset about it. It just is.
Good life lesson.
Well, I've carried, you know, and now I'm 67 and nagging people about it on the radio. And what gives the developed nations of the world the right to control the choices of the lesser developed nations?
They have no right, but they assert that right. They assert that dominion over everybody.
So what's the mechanism of doing that?
Laws, regulations, the money, telling these countries that if they kowtow to the far-left Marxist point of view, then they'll get some money for solar panels and so forth. And if they don't knuckle under, then we're just going to cut them off at the knees with foreign aid and so forth. And they're doing that on the agricultural front as well as the energy front. It's just abominable and I think unconscionable.
Kowtowing for anybody for money is simply a matter of deciding which orifice you're going to be violated in.
Yeah, I suppose you can look at it that way as well. And what I used to tell a couple of friends of mine in India when they were talking about foreign financing for Narmada Dam and other things like that is, look, in Africa too, same comments I would make to them. build it. We didn't have a World Bank in the United States or in Britain, for example. We didn't have all these foundations
for the Hoover Dam.
These other monies. Somebody got an idea. They got some friends together. They built something. If it worked, it was great. Otherwise, they lost their shirts. And they moved forward. They did these things. And we built an America. And the Africans should, and the Indians were, who are doing it. Finally, the Indian government said, screw the World Bank. We're going to build the Narmada Dam ourselves. We're not going to rely on the World Bank. The Chinese are doing the same thing. Finance it themselves. Push forward. They know what their people need, and so do the rest of these countries around the world who are at this point telling the World Bank and a lot of other places to stuff it because they need the energy, they need the affordability and the abundance, and they need energy that's there 24/7, not maybe a couple hours a day.
Who financed the Aswan Dam in Egypt?
Gosh, I do not know that particular story, but that goes back so many years.
Yeah, that's the '50s. Yeah.
Yeah. That's probably before the World Bank was doing a whole lot, but they probably got some foreign money for it because it was a huge project, and Egypt has never had that much money and power in modern eras. But that's an interesting question. We'll have to delve
it came to my mind when you were saying that. Let's see. The Aswan Dam was built downstream in 1902. Gee, I was wrong. More specifically, since the 1980s, the Aswan High Dam is one of the world's largest embankments. Which was built across the Nile in Aswan, Egypt between 1960 and 70. That's closer to what I said. When it was completed, it was the tallest earthen dam in the world, eclipsing the United States' Chattridge Dam. It doesn't say yet how they did it. Before the dam was built, I probably don't have time to research it. I'm sorry, what?
That's earthen dam?
Earthen, yeah. The
is
larger.
It really? I always assumed it was concrete.
So did I. Like I just learned something, yeah.
Wow.
Let's see. The original attempt was in the 11th century when Arab polymath engineer Ibn al-Haytham, known as Azathan in the West, was summoned to Egypt by the caliph. Let's see. The Low Dam, 1898 to 1902, that wasn't financed by any World Bank. The High Dam Prelude, 1954 to 60. That's that kind of, just the British had some involvement in it. I don't have time to read the whole thing on the air. And that's kind of a rabbit hole, and we're going to blow out the last 5 minutes, so don't do that, Charles. How do we go about empowering impoverished people to develop their own energy sources, absent building it for them or giving them a lot of money?
Give them the freedom to do it and tell these organizations to back off, including USAID and a whole lot of other U.S. and European organizations and government entities that are trying to dictate to these countries what they may and may not do out there. They've just got to let the African countries do what they need and support that need, support them financially and legally and through human rights organizations and so forth. Otherwise, what's going to happen is more and more the Chinese will come in and do their own version of lending and support with a lot of strings attached of their own.
Yeah, talk about predatory
that's
capitalism.
That's what's been happening.
Yeah. All right. Do we have sustainable mosquitoes?
Yeah, unfortunately, there's still a lot of battling against anything that's really going to work to stop the scourge of malaria and yellow fever in these countries, dengue fever, by controlling the mosquito populations and doing in those countries what we did in our country here. These disease-carrying mosquitoes need to be eradicated so that you break, and you have to have good medicines to help the people that get sick, so you break the cycle so that the mosquitoes bite somebody who's not infected with malaria, and the people that get bitten are bitten by mosquitoes that are not infected with malaria, for example. You have to break that cycle. It takes a few years and hard work, but the problem with the environmentalists is they don't want anybody going out there and killing these mosquitoes, especially using modern insecticides. So, again, you've got the eco-imperialists at work with very negative consequences for the poorest people on the planet.
Yeah, and there's the then the problem is the MCLU, the Mosquito Civil Liberties Union. All right. Do we always do well by doing good?
No. I mean, define good on either end of these things. Typically what you're talking about is companies that are supposedly following the dictates of the environmentalists and other DEI-type groups, ESG groups, and doing well financially by doing what those organizations say is good, because what those organizations say is good is not necessarily good for the average person. It might be good for those organizations that are pressuring the corporations, but it's not good for the average person out there.
Last question.
Next question.
Who gets rich off of climate change?
Oh, a whole lot of people. It's a $1 trillion-a-year operation at this point. You got the academics that get all this money to do their phony baloney computer modeling. You've got the activist groups that are pushing to get rid of fossil fuels. You've got all kinds of corporations that'll suck up all kinds of money, especially for wind and solar and battery power. If they get these subsidies and free rides on environmental reviews so that they don't have to jump through so many hoops like a regular company would have to do. There's all kinds of entities benefiting in many ways. The politicians ultimately benefit because they get the campaign money from all these other entities. And whatever government money they can give to them gets brought back to them through campaign contributions. So it's a massive industry, the environment, the climate industrial complex, I call it.
Sounds like one giant cluster something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, on that note, the book, again, is Eco-Imperialism. It's a 2003 book, or 2002? I forget.
Yeah, 2003. And the interesting thing is, I think, was very prescient and accurate, but maybe not the final chapter where I prophesied that maybe we're going to see an end to eco-imperialism because countries around Africa and elsewhere are rising up against it. But in reality, it's kind of like Freddy. It finds a new life of its own year after year and gets nastier and more browbeating every year, preventing countries from doing what they want to do. But there's a growing revolt against these imperialist ideas, this modern colonialism that we're seeing in the environmental arena.
That needs a whole book in and of itself devoted to that, Paul.
Yeah, probably.
It's that probably by somebody else, right?
Yeah. I'm not ready to revisit it except in my articles. I'm older than you are, so at some point I'm going to reduce my workload every week and enjoy some other things around the world, get involved in some other issues. It's still fun and it's still needed. And I'm glad to see so many countries telling the Marxist, fascist, eco-imperialist to stuff it. And they're not going to go along with this garbage because it's the worst thing possible for their people.
At some point, you got to go back down the kickapoo. All right.
Yep.
You have a great day.
You too, Charles. Thanks for having me back.
My pleasure. And...